Welcome to the Far and Beyond podcast, hosted by the Contracts and Fiscal Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. This podcast is for the federal government attorney navigating the complex intersection of acquisitions in fiscal law and policy. I am your host, Major Ellie Sewell.
And I'm Major Steve Soley.
Today, we're diving into a recent Supreme Court case with significant implications for service providers and clarifications on secondary liability in the field of copyright law. Cox Communications versus Sony Music Entertainment. The initial verdict at trial was $1 billion in favor of Sony, which was upheld by the circuit court. With me today to break it down is Major Steve Soley.
Yeah, again, glad to be here, Ellie. It addresses a big question. When is a service provider responsible for the illegal acts of its users in the field of copyright?
So let's start with the basics. Who are the parties and what is the issue?
All right. On one side, you have Sony Music and the other copyright holders. On the other, Cox Communications, one of the largest internet service providers or ISPs in the country. For years, Sony used a service called Mark Monitor to detect online copyright infringement. When they found a user illegally sharing music, they traced the activity to an IP address and they sent a notice to the corresponding provider, in this case, Cox. Over the two-year period, Sony sent Cox over 160,000 such notices.
So Sony tells Cox, your customers are pirating our music, and they did this thousands of times. Why did they sue Cox instead of the individual users who were actually doing the pirating?
Well, for two reasons. Scale and efficiency. Suing an individual infringer is like playing whack-a-mole. It's resource intensive and does little to stop the overall problem. Sony decided to go after the provider of the internet service itself. Their legal argument rested on a theory of secondary liability.
All right, secondary liability. I know I've heard this phrase, but can you break that down for us? What does that mean, and is it unique to copyright law?
Absolutely. Secondary liability is a legal doctrine that holds a party responsible for an infringement they do not commit directly. Instead of being the one who made the illegal copy, you are liable for enabling or profiting from the person who did. In copyright, this typically breaks down into two categories. The first category is called vicarious liability. This applies when you have the right and ability to supervise the infringer's activity and also derive a direct financial benefit from it. Think of a flea market owner who turns a blind eye to vendors selling counterfeit goods while collecting rent from them.
Oh, okay. That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, and then contributory liability, this is where you affirmatively induce infringement or where you knowingly contribute to somebody else's infringement. The classic example is providing tools or services that make an infringement possible while knowing what they're going to be used for. Think of your classic file share service like Napster or LimeWire.
Good old Napster. That's closed, right?
Yeah.
That's like millennial heart.
It was shut down. We're going to talk about it a little bit later, too. These theories are not at all unique to copyright. In fact, copyright secondary liability law closely tracks with patent secondary liability law, and the courts often look to one another for guidance. In this case, the court even states that copyright and patent law share a historic kinship, which I thought was rather sweet.
The Supreme Court being sweet. Interesting. So armed with this knowledge of secondary liability theories, what did Sony claim Cox did to make them liable?
All right. So their claim was that by continuing to provide internet services to subscribers that it knew were repeat infringers, Cox was contributorily infringing on their copyrights. The jury and the lower court actually agreed, finding Sony on both contributory and vicarious liability theories and awarded that $1 billion in statutory damages. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals later affirmed on the contributory liability finding, and their reasoning was that supplying a product with knowledge that the recipient will use it to infringe copyrights is exactly the sort of culpable conduct sufficient for contributory infringement. They reversed on the vicarious liability finding because Cox didn't make any money on
that
the actual
sense.
Infringement.
Yeah.
So this case was taken up by the Supreme Court because they obviously saw it different.
Okay, so the Supreme Court steps in to clarify this knowledge standard. The idea that knowledge alone makes you liable seems simple enough. What precedent did the court look to that suggests this might be wrong, though?
All right, yeah, the court actually went back to a foundational case in this area. Also a Sony case, Sony versus Universal City Studios, yeah, from 1984. often called the Betamax case or Sony Betamax. Universal Studios sued Sony for manufacturing the Betamax VCR, arguing that it was used for illegally copying television shows. The Supreme Court sided with Sony, establishing a critical doctrine. It held that distribution of a product does not constitute contributory infringement if the product is capable of substantial non-infringing use. A VCR can be used for legal time shifting or recording a show to watch it later, which is a fair use.
I am actually unfamiliar with that case, but it's so funny because you think of how many things did you tape as a child? Disney Channel movies, shows to watch later. Oh, we had like a lineup of all those VC, like those tapes we use just record over and over again.
Yeah, or just using a normal tape recorder to tape music on the radio.
Oh, yeah. I remember it was always like you waited for that song. The moment it came on, you hit record to see if you could get it, always missing the first 5 seconds.
I don't think our younger users are going to get that, though.
Oh, man. I do feel a little old now. All right. Thanks, Steve. So this really does make sense for a physical device like a VCR. But how does that apply to a service? Because internet's a little different than your physical VCR. And what happens when a company seems to be actively encouraging infringement, which wasn't the case with the VCR?
Yeah, you've actually hit the evolution of this doctrine on the head. The court addressed that very question in the 2005 case of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios versus Grokster. Grokster is a distributor of a peer-to-peer file sharing software. While the software could be used for a legal purpose, the software's entire business model was built on infringement.
And how did the court know that? How did they prove that intent?
We talked about Napster recently.
Yeah.
Through Grokster's own actions, the record was filled with that evidence. They marketed themselves as a direct alternative to Napster, which had just been shut down for massive copyright infringement themselves. Their internal communications and advertisements were aimed at satisfying the demand for free copyrighted content. One of those advertisements was, Napster Inc. has just announced that it will soon be charging you a fee. That's if the courts don't order it shut down first. What will you do to get around it? So the Grokster court established, I know.
That's fantastic.
I know. This is, these are exactly the client emails you do not want to have committed to writing.
Yeah.
Or the exact ones you want to find if you're on the other side. Yeah, exactly. So the Grokster court established what is now known as the inducement rule. It held that one who distributes a device with the object of promoting its use to infringe copyright is liable for the resulting infringement. This wasn't about passive knowledge, it was about active encouragement.
Okay, so we have two major principles here. So from Sony Betamax, the idea that a product capable of substantial lawful use is generally safe from liability. And from Grokster, the rule that actively inducing infringement creates liability. How did the court apply this framework, Zenda Cox?
Yeah, this two-part framework became the lens through which the Supreme Court analyzed Cox's conduct. The core question was no longer just about what Cox knew, but what Cox intended.
All right, so let's get to the main event, the Supreme Court's decision in Cox versus Sony. How did they apply the Sony and Grokster tests?
Well, they actually reversed the Fourth Circuit, holding that Cox was not contributorily liable. And they explicitly rejected the idea that mere knowledge of infringing use is sufficient to prove the required intent. Instead, it clarified that for contributory liability to attach to a service provider, the plaintiff must prove intent in one of two ways. Inducement, which we talked about, right? Did Cox take affirmative steps to foster infringement like Grokster or Napster, right? Mm-hmm. And here the court found no evidence of this. In fact, Cox had a contractual prohibition against infringement, had a 13-step system of warning and suspensions for accused infringers, and they would even turn off accounts if they had been warned multiple times. They were like, hey, I'm going to turn this off if you don't stop. And they would eventually turn it off. But for Sony, that wasn't fast enough, right? Mm-hmm. Was Cox's service, like the product in Sony, not capable of substantial non-infringing use, right? And internet service, is it capable of substantial non-infringing use? I mean, not like my 12-year-old self would say, no, internet is for copyrighted music. like my Napster or LimeWire accounts. But in this case, you have a lot of non-infringing use for the internet service provider. So in this case, the obvious answer is non-infringing use all day long by an internet service provider.
Okay, so since Sony couldn't prove either inducement or tailoring, their contributory liability claim failed. So this brings up another critical issue for our audience. The DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, has a safe harbor provision that shields ISPs from liability if they, among other things, implement a policy to terminate repeat infringers. Cox had lost its safe harbor protection in a previous case. Didn't that make them automatically liable?
Yeah, this is a vital takeaway for any attorney dealing with compliance. The court clarified that DMCA safe harbor is a shield, not a sword. It creates a defense from liability. It does not create liability itself.
Okay, so that's a huge clarification, actually. Was this case a unanimous decision?
I mean, it was a 9-0 case, but there were seven from majority, and Justice Sotomayor wrote a concurrence, and Justice Jackson joined her.
Okay, what was the focus of Justice Sotomayor's concurring opinion?
She argued that the majority went too far by limiting contributory liability to only the two prongs of inducement and tailoring. She believed the court should have also left the door open to other common law theories of secondary liability, such as aiding and abetting. She felt the majority's rigid rule unnecessarily constrained the law and could upend incentive structure Congress created with the DMCA.
So if she believes an aiding and abetting theory could apply, why did she still agree that Cox was not liable?
Because even under that theory, she found the plaintiffs couldn't prove necessary intent. Aiding and abetting liability requires intent to help specific wrongful act succeed. Here, Sony notices were tied to IP addresses and not people. So an IP address could be shared by a family, a coffee shop, this entire building, right? So Cox had no way to know who the actual infringers were. They were just IP addresses that they were providing services to. So without being able to identify the principal infringer, Cox could not form the requisite intent to help that person succeed on infringement. So this informational gap was fatal to that claim.
So let's bring this home for our audience of federal contract and fiscal law attorneys. What are the key takeaways from Cox and Sony?
Okay, I see two primary takeaways. A high bar for secondary liability in the field of copyright, right? For any organization providing a service, may it be internet, cloud hosting, or, you know, artificial intelligence, this rule seems to limit secondary liability theories in copyright. Mere knowledge that some users misuse a service is not enough. There must be concrete evidence of intent to foster infringement, either by inducement or by providing a service with no legitimate purpose.
I can see this popping up with AI soon.
Oh, yeah. But that's also why the second takeaway, the importance of policies, right? Cox's term of service, which prohibited infringement, and its response system to infringement notices from Sony, however imperfect, served as evidence against an intent to induce. For attorneys, this underscores the value of having a robust internal policy that actively discourages misuse of legitimate services. So like for us in the government, we would ensure that our policies where copyright is being infringed upon, we would say, hey, you can't do that, to prevent misuse.
Do you think that this means my internet bill will finally be cheaper?
Oh, gosh, you know, I hope so. Like everything, Cox probably has some of this tied to this decision, and they just, you know, landfall $1 billion. But, you know, large service provider, $1 million is probably like the $5 in my pocket right now.
True. All right, with that, I think that's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us today on this episode of Far and Beyond. Please make sure to follow us and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. We'd love to hear from our listeners. Please continue to reach out to us on Facebook and LinkedIn. The information can be found in the show notes from today's episode. The views expressed today are those of the presenters, not that of the Judge Advocate General Corps, the Department of the Army, Department of the Air Force, or the Department of War.